Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am very happy to welcome back Rick Pender. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
Rick, I was looking back. I didn't realize it had been so long since you were on. Rick was on back in 2021, 4 years ago.
Well, I've just been waiting for you to invite me.
I know.
I had to write another book to get your attention.
Yes, you had to write another book. Right, he was on originally because he had written the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia, and we were on talking about that back in 2021. And he has a new book that is coming out on October 2nd from Bloomsbury Academic. And it is called Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, Behind the Bloody Musical Masterpiece. And I have now read the book, and it is a wonderful, fun read for anyone who is a fan of Sondheim or of Sweeney Todd, which I am both. So I guess let's start off by talking about how this book came about for you. What led you to write this specific book about this specific Sondheim show?
Well, you mentioned the Stephen Sondheim Encyclopedia, which was published a couple of years ago. And of course, in doing that, I really explored broadly across all of Sondheim's numerous shows. But I have to say that Sweeney Todd was one of the first shows that I really tuned in and paid attention to not long after it came out. I mean, I knew a little bit some of his early work. I was aware of his involvement in West Side Story, and I'd seen a production of A Little Night Music, which I liked very much. But having seen that and then hearing that he was doing a musical about a serial killer and disposing of body parts through meat pies, well, that's certainly a departure. So I was kind of fascinated by it. But, you know, then I started tuning in more and more. I got to hear the music from it, from the cast recording. I did not actually get to see the original production, but I did see productions as it began to be out on tour and by other theaters. And I just have been constantly fascinated with it for a vast number of reasons. I really consider it, and I'm not the only one, consider it to be Sondheim's masterpiece. So the publisher of the encyclopedia actually came back to me and asked if I was interested in doing a follow-up book of some kind, perhaps focused on a specific show. Mm-hmm. And it took me maybe 5 seconds to say, I think Sweeney Todd would be the perfect choice for this.
Right. Well, and I think also because I think it's smart choice for many reasons. One, because I think you're right, a lot of people consider it probably Sondheim's best work. But also because there's so much rich history when you delve into the show, because it's not, first off, it's not an original idea like something like Company, and it's not something that's just based on a film like A Little Night Music, which is also another great Sondheim show. Sweeney Todd has a very long history. I love the book. The book is really great because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is, first off, I like the fact that you pretty quickly, because a lot of people, as you said, you yourself said that you felt like, wow, Stephen Sondheim is tackling a musical about a serial killer, and it's a really dark kind of show. But you yourself kind of explain or kind of refute the concept that it was something totally different for him, because you kind of talk about, and I hadn't really thought that much about it either until I read your chapter, your section on this, where you talked about him writing the score for Evening Primrose and writing a musical score and some songs for this TV film that has kind of a bit of a dark side to it, as well as the progression of the complexities and sophistication of his scores once he started working with Hal Prince in the 1970s. And once you read that chapter, Sweeney Todd sort of becomes sort of a logical progression. It kind of fits into the logic of Sondheim wanting to stretch himself and take on different things. And you can see that it actually does kind of fit into, you know, it wasn't completely illogical for him to try something like this.
I'm not sure if I would say necessarily that it was a progression, because
right.
some of, you know, I mean, each one of those works, particularly with Hal Prince, were markedly different from one another.
Right. And
each one of them showed different aspects of Sondheim's musical genius, of his lyric writing skills, and all of that kind of thing. But I will, and I know in part, I'm glad you reference the Evening Primrose, because I think there is definitely some sort of prior experience that he had that made sense, because not only was it sort of a dark, slightly creepy kind of story, but he wrote a lot of underscoring for that.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually, his fascination with that actually goes back to his boyhood, when he was seeing movies, and he actually was particularly a fan of scary movies, horror stories, that sort of thing. And at the age of 15, he saw a movie called Hangover Square that was about a serial killer, in fact. This particular person was a composer who is writing a concerto, but it had within it some musical notes that whenever he heard them, he would like black out and go out and murder somebody. I mean, it's not a very sophisticated story, but Sondheim was fascinated with it. He saw it at the age of 15. He went back into the movie theater to watch it again so that he could memorize the score, at least the sheet of music that was on the keyboard as the composer was performing it. And Sondheim said, even as an adult, he could still play that piece from memory. So it goes back a long way. And the other feature of that was that had a score by Bernard Herrmann. And Bernard Herrmann, who did so many movies, movie scores like for Alfred Hitchcock and that sort of thing, that's very much an influence on Sondheim in doing the particular score for Sweeney Todd. And he admitted that and attributed his passion for what Bernard Herrmann did often when he was talking about the show.
Right. Yeah, I found it very interesting when you talked about that in the book. And I recommend the book as a great read, just because you do cover, it's not a book that's just a fan book about, oh, Sweeney Todd's such a great musical, blah, blah, blah. It's not, because you go really in depth into the whole history of Sweeney Todd in terms of where the origins of the story comes from. So talk a little bit about that as well, and talk about the role Christopher Bond played and the whole origins of Sweeney, the character of Sweeney Todd, and how it grew out of these tales that came out of France and then also England. And it's like hundreds of years old. I mean, this tale of a quote unquote demon barber seeking revenge, or just a serial killer, or I mean, it gets convoluted and twisted around so many different ways through the years.
It was great fun for me to write, because I had, I don't know, I guess sort of a vague familiarity that Sweeney Todd was this sort of, you know, boogeyman kind of character. But beyond that, I didn't know very much about the early roots of the story. So that required some more research on my part to really, really dig into that. There's a cute story about Angela Lansbury. When she got approached to play Mrs. Lovett in this, she said, well, she knew Sweeney Todd. She was British, grew up in London, in the neighborhood more or less where Fleet Street is. But she said it was just always there was this sort of thing that children were warned, you better behave or Sweeney Todd will catch you up and put you into a meat pie.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I knew there was a little bit of that. But when I dug into it, I learned with quite a bit of fascination that the stories came from more or less the 1840s, when there was a publishing kind of phenomenon, I guess I would say, of serialized tales that were often quite gory and horrifying and that sort of thing. And they were called penny dreadfuls. Because they were published in serialized form, and they were just maybe 8 or 16 pages, and they sold for a penny. And dreadful, of course, is a good description of what much of the subject matter was. So the particular one that was the most direct ancestor of the story that we know now came out in something called A String of Pearls. And the story of that actually in that Sweeney Todd was a somewhat lesser character. He was simply someone who was murdering people to rob them. And mm-hmm. there was not much more motivation than that for it. But as it took further shape, he became a more fascinating character and became a more central character in subsequent iterations. When that came out in the 1840s, out of one of the presses that did that sort of thing, it actually came out in 47 installments. So there was a lot of, you know, additional things, side stories and things that added into it. It eventually then was published in more of a bound volume. But in fact, even before that happened, people started picking up on the story. And this one fellow by the name of George Dibden Pitt took the story and turned it into a stage melodrama, even mm-hmm. before the last of the chapters had been published. So it was a pretty flexible a piece of material over time, and people kept playing with it. Dibden Pitt's melodrama was what really sort of lasted through the latter part of the 19th century, although there were many other iterations of it that people undertook because copyright was not anything that, you know, kept anybody from stealing material.
Right.
There was a barber and his wife, and she was beautiful. A foolish barber and his wife, she was his reason and his life, and she was beautiful, and she was virtuous, and he was naive. There was another man who saw that she was beautiful, a pious vulture of the law, who with a gesture of his claw removed the barber from his plate. Then there was nothing but to wait, and she would fall, so soft, so young, so lost, and oh, so beautiful.
The lady, sir, did she succumb?
Oh, that was many years ago. I doubt if anyone would know.
Now leave me, Antony. I beg of you. There's somewhere I must go, something I must find out, now and alone.
So long then, Mr. Todd.
There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it.
So, and it was Dibden Pitt's script that eventually came into the hands of Christopher Bond, who then developed it in the early 1970s into a more psychologically motivated stage production. So how that came about, he was in Bond was an actor in a company that was out in the hinterlands in England, and he had been in a previous production of some sort of melodrama, and the producers said, oh, let's do another one of those. And somebody pulled out Dibden Pitt's script and said, oh, how about this one? So they thought, okay, fine. And Bond said, oh, I can adapt that. Well, it got to be about 2 weeks before curtain time, and he hadn't really sat down and worked on it, and he did, and then thought, oh, this is really not very good. You know, it's still pretty rough. And so he really gave it the story that more or less that we recognize in Sondheim's version today. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. with the motivation of the evil judge and Sweeney seeking revenge for sending him off to Australia and then raping his wife and now having possession of his daughter as the judge's ward and all of that. That all came from the mind of Christopher Bond.
Right.
So, and then Sondheim saw a production of that when he was in London in 1975, I think it was. And he thought, oh, I could make a musical out of this.
Uh-huh.
That way his mind worked, apparently, anyway, and pursued it a little bit further. Some producers had seen what Bond's production was and had actually already optioned it to bring over to Broadway. And it was some quick negotiation happened as soon as Bond and others recognized that Sondheim was interested. They pretty much said, okay, come on board. Well, we're all in for that. It took a little while. Sondheim was still in the midst of finishing up Pacific Overtures at that time. So it really wasn't until the latter years of the 1970s that he really settled in to try to craft this into a show. Mm-hmm. And his initial intention had been that he was going to write the book for it.
Yeah.
But he started down that path and he said he had worked through about 5 pages of Bond's script, and he said he already had like 2 hours worth of material. And he said, we're going to end up with, it'll be Wagnerian in scope.
Right, exactly.
Maybe we better think about handling this in some different way. So by that time, he was working with Hal Prince, who was going to direct the show, and Prince said to him, how about let's bring Hugh Wheeler in? And they had worked together on A Little Night Music. And so Wheeler really tightened the script up in many ways and made it fit in ways with the music that Sondheim wanted to create. It's still a rather long show. It is about 3 hours long when it is fully produced.
Right.
But, you know, I give Wheeler as much credit as Sondheim, frankly, for the impact of the show. Without his really refinement of some of the language and the stories, and of course, Sondheim, as was his wont in so many of the things that he did, he would pick up material from what the book writer was doing and weave that into songs that would then put forth character and situation and all that sort
right.
of thing. So they really teamed quite effectively.
Yeah, I want to, before we get too far along, I really want to also commend you for all the research on the origins of the character of Sweeney Todd. And because that section of the book is just a fascinating read, to read all the different versions of Sweeney Todd. You put a really good synopsis of String of Pearls in the book. So you can read it and you go, and you can see all the little bits and pieces that ultimately would kind of become closer and closer to what Christopher Bond created ultimately in his version of Sweeney Todd. But you can also see, because you also talk about other variations of the character that were out there, and you talk about copycats and people trying to go around. And you also talk, but one of the great things is you also talk about these writers who kept insisting that Sweeney Todd was a real person, and they were convinced they were going to try and track down the historical record of the real Sweeney Todd, which was ridiculous because there was no real Sweeney Todd.
No, but one writer did a lengthy job of creating some kind of historical background for it,
right.
adding dates and events and all sorts of things, none of which were either documented or able to be pursued. So I did want to debunk some of that, because some people think, oh, this must be based on some, you know, crazy story
from right.
historian England.
Especially when you consider the fact that as you mentioned with Angela Lansbury, she, of course, was familiar with the tale of Sweeney Todd because as a child, there were the rhymes and the things about Sweeney Todd and the meat pies and all that kind of stuff, because Sweeney Todd was already ingrained in British culture. And even as you mentioned, when String of Pearls came out and how it was copied and disseminated through the Penny Dreadfuls, and then that turned into stage melodramas that were sometimes performed in pubs, you know, like rundown pubs would do performances of their version of the tale of Sweeney Todd. And, but then by the 20th century, Sweeney Todd was on the radio. Sweeney Todd was in silent film. There was a British talking picture version of Sweeney Todd in the mid 1930s. So it's like Sweeney Todd was
an actor with the unlikely name of Slaughter.
Yeah, right.
Probably a name that he adapted because he played the role on stage quite a bit too.
Right. So it was like Sweeney Todd was very well associated to the British public. I mean, they knew the character, they knew the story, they knew this concept. So for American audiences with this Broadway production of Sweeney Todd by Sondheim, to us it was this brand new thing. You know, it was we were not familiar with the character or the story or the legend or the myth or whatever you want to call it of Sweeney Todd. So for us, it was like, oh, that must be based on a real person or it must be whatever. When in reality, thanks to your book, you really trace the entire lineage of the character and where the character came from and how it ultimately ended up today, now mostly associated with this musical.
Yeah,
because
I would also point out that we've mentioned Hugh Wheeler's contributions.
Right.
Wheeler was British and had written some novels and plays and things of his own. And he was very much familiar with murder mysteries and that sort of thing. So he was ultimately a perfect choice to be the book writer for this. And that made a big difference, I think.
Right. And so let's kind of talk about, you know, we've talked about Sondheim and Prince working together, but they had very opposed ideas as to what this production should look like, because I mean Sondheim had seen Bond's production in London, which was very small scale. It was, and like I said, this was being performed as melodramas in relatively small venues, in, you know, back theaters in pubs and places like that. And so I think he envisioned a much smaller, intimate setting to make it creepy and scary and all that kind of stuff. And Hal Prince, on the other hand, was envisioning a much bigger, you know, Industrial Revolution theme where, you know, totally different idea. Yep. Prince obviously won out because the original production was gigantic in scale.
Well, you know, I think that is the first step in a long line of how many different ways can we produce Sweeney Todd?
Exactly.
And Sondheim said, you know, that he and Prince, they really had to sort of have quite a bit of dialogue about it. And they came to a bit of common ground, I guess, in that, you know, Prince really wanted to talk about the evils that society imposed on the downtrodden and that sort of thing, and how that drove them to extreme action. Whereas Sondheim's sense was this was a story about obsession and vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
Those two aren't all that far apart, so they were able to mesh. But indeed, as you say, the production that that Prince produced was really operatic in scale, and in fact that probably also set the path where the show could go on and be done at opera houses too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where they want everything to be sort of grand and over the top. However, you know, as we look over time at how the show has been produced, Sondheim's desires for the show, which he often said he really had envisioned it in a small place, dark curtained, that the people would get in and would not be quite settled in their seats when the lights would go out and we'd start hearing the ballad of Sweeney Todd, you know, which is the sort of the opening number. And I think that that's, you know, that was clearly what he had hoped would happen. And I think that he didn't feel that got lost completely, but it was a very different balance than he had in mind. So when some of these smaller productions came about, the one that was at Circle in the Square, really the first Broadway revival of it, that one, which was sort of jokingly referred to as Teeny Todd.
Right.
Because it was, you know, had a much smaller cast and just a smaller physical production, and yet people loved it that way. It has gone on to even smaller. You know, more recently there was a production of it in a pie and mash shop in London that was actually brought over to New York, and they built a pie shop on the stage of an off-Broadway theater, and people could actually go into the pie shop on the stage and see it performed there, as well as John Doyle's actor-musician production, which only, it was all a single set, nothing very gigantic about it, and much more focused on some of the symbolism and that sort of thing. So lots of different ways, and yet in almost every way that it's been produced, people have responded to it, and I don't know if I can say they love it, but they love being scared by it, I guess.
I also did not realize that there was a Music Theater International School Edition of Sweeney Todd, which I don't think I realized, because you even have, I think, a couple of photos in there from school productions. And I mean, I don't mean like high school necessarily. I mean, they're like... It's like Sweeney Todd Jr., basically.
Yeah, yeah. I think they call it school edition. I'm not sure they're junior high kids
doing it,
but they do that. And I live in Cincinnati, and a few of our high schools here have produced it. And I saw one of those. They didn't like take much out of it. There are a few places where things are a little more adult and off color. The beggar woman soliciting Sweeney and Anthony at the beginning.
And
sometime actually change some of the language to make it more palatable for schools to do that sort of thing. There have been schools that have wanted to produce it where the local PTA got all up in arms over it. So it has not been without controversy, but it, I think, is a fairly popular one. And of course, teenagers think that this is kind of cool to do a show with, you know, a lot of horror and blood and that sort of thing.
Right. I'm sure they love the razor with the blood coming out of it.
And
as you said, it's controversial. And at the time, I mean, when it opened on Broadway, the critics were not necessarily all on board with the show. I mean, it didn't necessarily get rave reviews.
It got very mixed reviews at first, although it wasn't too long before more and more positive estimations came upon it. And don't hear very much of that any longer. So,
yeah, it took a while for people to kind of reassess the show, I guess.
You know, that has been, I mean, to just step back a few, with many of Sondheim's shows, people didn't always get them at first.
Right.
And needed to hear them, see them, get a little bit more understanding of them. And I think that's very much what happened with this show. At first, people were horrified. I mean, how could you have a show about people getting their throats cut and, you know, blood and all of that sort of thing? But, and I know you probably want to talk a little bit about Tim Burton's movie.
Yeah, we'll get to Tim. We'll get to the Tim Burton movie.
Talk about your blood. There's a lot of blood in that
movie. Yes, there was a lot of blood in that movie.
Yes.
But before we get to the movie version, the other thing that's also interesting is that the London production, after the first Broadway production, was not a success.
And I
don't think even the many award winning revivals of the show in London, none of them have been huge commercial successes over there. And I guess it's because, as we said a moment ago, Sweeney Todd is so ingrained in the culture over there in terms of a character that there's not really anything unique about a musical about Sweeney Todd.
Well, there were subsequent productions in London. You're right, absolutely, that the London debut of the show only ran for like 150 some performances. And Sondheim was very disappointed. He said that this was his love letter to London, which is sort of a curious thing to offer up as a love letter. But you know, subsequently, a Irish director named Declan Donnellan did a production of it that was much smaller and more intimate, and Sondheim thought that was an excellent production, and it played reasonably well. And of course, when Doyle's actor-musician production came, it went through a number of regional theaters before it came to London, and then moved from, you know, smaller to larger venues, and was quite successful. So I think that they got into it a little bit more over time.
Right. And let's before we get too far away from the original Broadway production, talk a little bit about the casting. Because it was sort of like the, you know, Len Cariou and Angela Lansbury were basically going to be Sweeney Todd and Mrs. Lovett from the very beginning.
Yes, absolutely. They knew, Prince and Sondheim knew Cariou because he had played Frederick Egerman in A Little Night Music, a totally different kind of role. In that one, he was a sort of a mousy, indecisive attorney.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I don't think you would have automatically looked at him and thought, oh, serial.
Right, exactly.
But he was a fine actor. He's Canadian. He had played King Lear. He did a lot of Shakespeare in Canada. They very much thought of him from the very beginning. He was artistic director at a theater, I think it was in Manitoba, and he had written a note to Prince to ask for the stage manager's book for Company, because he was doing a production of that and wanted to look at some of the notes that were in that. And when he did that, Prince said to him, oh, Steve's working on a show that we have you in mind for. And he said, I'll send you some of this. And so Cariou got it. And then he was in New York and he went to Sondheim's home to hear some of the music. And he was kind of astonished that with what was being created. He thought, you know, this is pretty serious, heavy stuff. But he also thought, done the right way, and these two guys are the people to do it, it could be great. So yes, from the very beginning, he was in on it.
Out, I say, out!
This rumbling, shouting, what is it now, dear?
I had him, and then...
Oh, no, the sailor busted, and I saw them both running down the street, and I said...
His sword was there beneath my hand.
Now, dear, don't fret.
No, I had it. His sword was there, and he'll never come again.
Easy now. Hush now, hush. I keep telling you.
When?
Watch your mouth.
Why did I wait? You told me to wait. Now he'll never come again. There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. All deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. No, we all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief, for the rest of us death will be a relief. We all deserve to die, and I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, readers. You, sir, anybody, gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor ten men, nor a hundred can assuage me. I will have you. Get him back, even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive at last, and I'm
Lansbury had been in a production of a show, a Sondheim show that didn't ever do very well, called Anyone Can Whistle, which was about 15 years before Sweeney Todd. Sondheim and Arthur Lawrence, who wrote the book for that one, had really talked Lansbury into doing it, although she had never had a singing role on stage or on screen. She had mostly been a film actress in the 40s and 50s, but they thought that her British roots, she had sort of a Cockney background, that she would be right for that, and took a little bit of convincing. She talked with Sondheim about it, and she was a little hesitant because by that time she'd already had considerable success with a couple of other shows, including MAME, mm-hmm. and Gypsy. And so she thought, well, you know, the show's about Sweeney Todd. It's not really about Mrs. Lovett. But once Sondheim shared with her some of the music, she thought, all right, I really have to do this. And she and Carreyrou had a great time working on the show. They talked about how, and I have some of this in the book, each of their perspectives on it, that he played it as deadly serious, and she played it as this sort of, ironic, darkly comic kind of thing. And she said, we had to push everything right up to the very edge of making it silly, and it really worked that way. So mm-hmm. they really teamed beautifully, and I'm sure that Prince played a big hand in balancing that that dynamic between the two of them.
Yeah, the way that the two roles are written, and you can see that it's so interesting. It's of all the musicals, classic musicals, and I consider Sweeney a classic musical at this point. Yeah. You can see how the roles were so tailored to these two specific actors who created the roles, and that you can see that with a lot of shows, but with this you really can see it because the balance between the two characters and how they're played is so crucial to making the show work.
Yeah, and especially I think that Lansbury's stamp on that role, I think, very much impacted subsequent productions. Sort of, not that they set out to just do it as Angela had done it, but it was clear that the songs were written with her in mind, and that the way that it could best be played. I don't think that Carreyrou's performance had quite that lasting effect.
No. But
that role is so powerfully written that it can be picked up by others. I was interested, I didn't mention, but as we talked about subsequent productions, the recent production with Josh Groban on Broadway,
mm-hmm.
The actress who played Mrs. Lovett.
Oh, Annalee Ashford, yeah.
Yeah, Annalee Ashford, I thought gave it she was played it younger, mm-hmm. and more enamored of Sweeney than in the same ways, more overtly enamored of him, hanging on him frequently and that sort of thing. And she was just physically funny to watch with all of her bumping up and down the steps and mm-hmm. all of those kinds of things. So she put a somewhat different spin on the role, I thought. But by and large, people who have done the role, there's Angela's spirit is conjured up in most
productions. Oh yeah, I definitely agree about that. So let us now move on to what you mentioned a moment ago, and that is the 2007 film by Tim Burton, of Sweeney Todd, which you cover very, very extensively in the book. And you also make a very good case for why it should not be dismissed so readily by Sondheim purists, which unfortunately it has been over the years.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, there's a lot of purists out there who are like, well, there's so much that's been cut and the performers can't sing as well as stage performers. And you make a really good case, which I'm going to let you go ahead and make that case right now, as to why it's not really fair to compare the two. The film and the stage version, and why you can't also completely discard it because Sondheim was so intimately involved in this.
Right. That's right. Well, there's a very pragmatic reason that some things had to be done with it. As I mentioned a little bit ago, the stage production is about 3 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't a lot of movies that can hold somebody's interest for that much time. I mean, 2 hours is sort of a standard length for movie, for successful movies. So that was part of it. And with Tim Burton directing it, it was bound to take a rather different sort of overall ethos for the storytelling, because he's very much into the macabre and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He also felt, and Sondheim agreed with him, as Sondheim really is as much a movie buff as he is somebody who loves musicals and that sort of thing. And he quickly recognized that the citizens of London who are singing the Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd, that they are interruptive of the action. Whereas in a movie, you want things to move swiftly.
Mm-hmm.
Sondheim in particular, he said one of his irritations about opera is that sometimes it takes so long to sing some aria about, oh, you know, we're out of wine, we want more wine, let's have wine.
Right.
And,
uh-huh.
You know, and he just sort of wants to get on to what happens after you drink all that wine. So I think they agreed that losing that element and focusing on something that is much harder to focus on stage, and that is the inner emotions of the characters. In film, you can catch close-ups, close-up faces of Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter and others, and some of the victims even. It makes it much more frightening in that way, whereas on stage, you know, it's a much more expansive kind of thing.
Right.
So the psychological dimension of it was very much important. The volume of blood is something that a lot of people objected to in the movie, and as I read more about it, both from the people who were on the tech side who created pumps that made blood spurt like 3 feet out and that sort of thing, they felt that Burton really wanted it to be over the top, almost so that you would realize this isn't real, this is almost like a cartoon that mm-hmm. is happening here. So I think there was some justification for that. And the objections to the vocal skills, particularly of the two leads, I think their singing was passable for it. And in part, I don't have objection to it because they, again, we were focused on their emotions, on their psyches. We saw them up close. You could feel those emotions. You didn't need a song elaborately sung to convey some of the things that were being done cinematically. The other point that I want to make about that is that I think it was Paul Gemignani who conducted it. He said, well, Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter could not have done this show 8 times a week. They didn't have voices. They didn't have Broadway stage voices to be able to do that sort of thing. But he said their voices were fine for conveying the story. And so to me, hearing that from someone like Gemignani, who conducted most of the music for the film and for the original production and for, you know, several revivals and that sort of thing, said to me that, you know, this should be considered more seriously. It's a different medium and it works well. Sondheim was very pleased with the result.
This I know you've been locked out of sight all these years. Like me, my friend, well, I've come home to find you waiting. Home, and we're together, and we'll do wonders, won't we? Me hold you.
If you only
now,
with
a sigh,
you
grow warm in my hand, my friend, my clever friend.
Always had a fondness for you, I did.
Rest now, my friend.
Never you fear,
I'll unfold you.
You can move in
soon.
Now
splendors
you never have dreamed all your days.
And the film did very well at the box office. It really did. And I remember going to see the film. I think I went on opening weekend. Because I was curious and anxious to see it. I like Tim Burton's work, but I've not always been a big fan, only because I find Tim Burton is a visual stylist. And usually gets tripped up with bad scripts. The movies can tend to be really gorgeous to look at or fantastic to watch, but there's oftentimes a script problem. But with this one, I knew that wasn't going to be an issue because he's dealing with a property that's so well written. But I was curious to see how he would put his stamp on it. And I went in not necessarily expecting that Helena Bonham Carter and Johnny Depp were going to sing like I was watching a Broadway performance. I knew that wasn't going to happen. But I felt that because of Tim Burton's style, you never really felt that you were in a realistic London. I mean, his settings never look 100% realistic anyway, but it certainly captured the mood and the tone and his color palettes that he and his art directors used and the costume designers used set the tone for telling a tall tale of this horror story that's lived for hundreds of years in British history, and they're telling it on screen. And I agree with you. I think the intimacy of the camera makes it so that you don't necessarily have to be a fantastic singer to sing these songs. It's more about the acting performances. And I was thoroughly satisfied, and I didn't necessarily feel that the songs that were cut were damaging at all.
you know, if people want that, they can go see a production of
right.
a
Right, exactly.
Or listen to the cast recording.
Right, it's a totally different medium.
Yeah, yeah. So I really don't have a problem with any of that. And the fact that Sondheim was, and, you know, I think that part of perhaps the advance fretting about all of this was from a lot of Sondheim fans who had seen movies made of some of his other
right.
films. That, I mean, when a funny thing happened on the way to the forum, I mean, half the music was thrown out right. and it just became sort of a silly farce and lost some of the clockwork of the plotting of that original production. When they did A Little Night Music, which Hal Prince directed, but it was quite the bomb, in part because Elizabeth Taylor was cast in it, and she was just not really right for the role of Desiree. So there were a lot of people who were thinking, oh my gosh, here's going to be another great Sondheim show that's going to be turned into some kind of wrong movie. And then they heard that some of the music was being dropped out of it, and so all that anticipation piled up. As it was opening, Sondheim said, just go to see it and judge it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Don't spend time arguing that we lost this or we should have had that. And he said, if you do that, I think that you'll find it a good piece of movie making. He liked to say that he thought it was the best translation of a musical to the movie screen of anything that he, certainly of anything of his, but mm-hmm. of almost any musical that he knew of.
Right. Plus, hey, when you're dealing with a film and a film size budget, usually you get a really nice big orchestra too. So you get a beautifully orchestrated score. Yes, and you yep. sure do with this. You sure do yeah, with this one. Yeah.
You also made the point about the costuming and the scenic design, and those both won Academy Awards.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it was a very successful film in so many ways. And I think that actually, it's funny, as I've talked to people just in my personal acquaintance about this book, they know the film. They may have never seen the movie. And So it's interesting to me. I think that it probably over time has seen more than all of the stage productions put together. So, you know, I think it's one more way that sometimes fame and genius can be spread even more broadly.
Exactly. As we're wrapping up here, tell me, in your opinion, now that you've researched Sweeney Todd and researched the ongoing legacy of the show, what in your opinion makes Sweeney Todd such a perfect show?
Well, some of the things we've touched on, the plotting, the characters, the motivation, all of those kinds of things, I think make it a great piece of storytelling. But the other aspect of it, which is perhaps a little more subtle, but not really, is the musical score. I mean, 80% of this show has music behind it. Some of the spoken dialogue does, some of the songs weave in and out of dialogue. So there is it is so intricately scored. I mean, Sondheim uses techniques that we think of as being more operatic called leitmotifs, that is, particular musical themes or threads that are repeated at particular moments. I mean, the Tale of Sweeney Todd, the there's a set of notes in that he derived from the 13th century Mass of the Dead called the Dies Irae, the Day of Judgment. And he used some of those musical threads in it, particularly in the Tale of Sweeney Todd. But also there are other places where if you listen carefully over time, you can hear this stuff repeating and repeating. And there are little hints. There's a hint at the very beginning when the beggar woman solicits Sweeney and Anthony when they're getting off the boat, and the music behind it is some of the music that you hear at the very end when he finds her body in the shop basement afterwards, when he has inadvertently killed her, didn't realize that it was his wife. And mm-hmm. so that music very subtly threads all of those kinds of things together. So to me, that is something, maybe it's a little more subtle. People don't go to it necessarily and think, oh, I'm going to see a great piece of music making, but it is that music. It gives the forward momentum for the story. Heightens and underscores the emotion of the musical number Epiphany when Sweeney gets his razors that he thought he had lost, that Mrs. Lovett has kept for him for 15 years while he was gone. He gets them and decides that, oh my gosh, he says, you know, my arm is complete at last. He's mm-hmm. got that razor in his hand. He knows what his destiny is. And the music behind that is so interesting to hear, some very dissonant sounds that you can almost hear his mind sort of cracking. And it's right after that that he begins to think about sort of lashing out, not just going after the judge, but sort of like taking vengeance on all mankind. And all of that is underscored and supported by his music.
So do you have a favorite musical moment in the score?
Oh gosh.
I'm sure you have many.
I do. And but I can point, Epiphany is one that I would mention, but what comes from beyond that, once we get through all of this, you know, he does this horrendous, you know, that he's about to take off on a murdering spree, and Mrs. Lovett stops him and says, well, that's all fine, but what are we going to do with the body here? And that is what leads into the song called A Little Priest, which is, of course, a very macabre piece of music, but it is also very funny. You know, it's like, what kind of pies can we make from the various professions that he has managed to slice and dice? And, you know, what's going to be popular? Priest is what he ultimately, what Sweeney ultimately recommends. But there are, Sondheim in his writing, brainstormed over 100 potential professions that he could have woven into this song, and that is it's a funny number, and it lets the steam out after this mental break that we've seen. And Sweeney keeps trying in that song to harken back to I want to know when there's some judge on the menu, and but it lightens it up, and then we go to intermission. So it does that. And when we come out of intermission, then we're in the song called God That's Good, where Mrs. Lovett's meat pie business is suddenly taken off, and it is almost, in a sense, sort of a continuation of the very funny stuff that happened, you know, with the little priest number. So that stretch of music is one that I would point to, and it's under and you know, while the God That's Good is going on, simultaneously, the barber chair is being delivered to Sweeney's barbershop.
Right.
You know, the chair that will drop people down after he cuts their throats, send them down to the meat grinder. And all of that is all perfectly underscored to knit it all together. An amazing piece of music.
Have your attention, please. Are your nostrils a-quiver and tingling as well at that delicate, luscious, ambrosial smell? Yes, they are, I can tell. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that aroma enriching the breeze is like nothing compared to its succulent sauce, as the gourmets among you will tell you, of course. Ladies and gentlemen, you can imagine the rapture in store just inside of this door. There you'll sample Mrs. Lovett's meat pies, savory and sweet pies, as you'll see. You who eat pies, Mrs. Lovett's meat pies, conjure up the treat pies used to be.
Over here, boy, how about some care? Let me have your clothes, lady. Put me on some service.
Come, excuse me, Albert.
Great mum, quick now.
God, that's good.
the gentlemen hear the birdies cheeping, helps to keep it cheery. Toby, throw the young woman out.
Toby's good.
What's your pleasure, dearie? No, we don't cut slices. Call me, ours is bleary. Toby, none for the gentlemen. I could up me prices. I'm a little leery. Business couldn't be better though.
Toby's good.
Knock on wood. See to the customers. Yes, what, love, quick, the trade is risky.
But it's 6 o'clock.
So it's 6 o'clock.
It was due to arrive at 4:45.
And it's probably already down the bucket of beer.
I've been waiting all day.
Watch your pleasure, dearie. Whoops, I beg your pardon. Just me hands is smeary. Tell me, run for the gentleman. Don't you love the garden? Always makes me teary. Must be one of the foreigners.
The best good that is delicious.
What's my secret? Frankly, dear, forgive my kind of family secret. All to do with herbs. Things like being careful with your coriander. That's what makes the gravy grander. Dear, see to the customers. Yes, what, love, quick, though the trade is brisk.
But it's here.
It's where?
Coming up the stairs.
I get rid of the slaughters, they're still pretty hot and
the
lobby there.
It's about to be open, though, don't you care?
There will be, there
but
will
we
be,
have to prepare.
There will be sound of fun, and they're called on. Incidentally, dearie, you know Mrs. Mooney. Sales have been so dreary. Toby, poor thing is penniless. What about that loony? Lumpkins all got beery. Oh, well, gotta come up, and so that will be throuples and...
Yes, you're
I know you'll be ready to go
floor.
When you pound the floor. Will you trust me? Will
I just want to be sure.
I've been waiting for love for
but I'm certain that you're in place. I'll pound 3 times. 3 times. And then you. 3 times. If you. Exactly.
Right.
So, and one of the things that's also nice in the book is you kind of close the book after you cover the whole history of the show. You kind of close the book with a section where you talk about various, I don't know how to describe it, topics/issues/ talking points, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. Is Sweeney Todd an opera or not an opera? Is it, you have, there's different discussions, which I will leave to the readers to read, because they were all really fascinating kind of topics that you kind of, what you focus on, you spotlight. And then you also include a section where you talk about cast recordings, and you talk about, because you've listened to the cast recordings and said, here are my opinions on the handful of the cast recordings that are out there, because there's a lot of Sweeney Todd cast recordings out there. Do you have a favorite one? I mean, it's hard to not love the original just because it is the original, but there are a lot of cast recordings out there.
That that if I had to pick one, you know, if I had to go to a desert island and take only one with me, it would be the original cast recording. Such an interesting recording. Thomas Shepard, who was the recording engineer on that, who did a number of Sondheim's cast recordings, really dug into this one and wanted to make it into almost like a radio play with some sound effects and things like that in it. So to me, that is the most complete rendering of the show, and I think Sondheim probably felt that way about it. But there are other recordings. I mean, I frankly, this is a very minority opinion, I think, but the Doyle production with the actor musicians, I mean, to me, that's such a phenomenal thing. Those actors had to not only learn their roles and memorize that and their blocking, they had to memorize the music that they were playing. They didn't have sheet music in front of them or anything. Mm-hmm. And, and the whole score had to be reorchestrated for the particular musical talents of those people. So I find that one fascinating to listen to. The one other one that I would point to is the New York Philharmonic concert production of it, which includes almost all of the music, which even in the original cast recording, there were some that got amplified as time went on. So if you really want to hear the whole thing, it's all on that recording. That one has George Hearn and Patti LuPone in the leading roles.
Yeah, that's a really good one. Also, there you can't really go wrong with any of the cast recordings out there, because they're all sort of unique in their own way. They're all solid Sweeney Todd recordings, because you can't go wrong with Sweeney Todd. Yeah. But you're at least going to hear a lot of interesting performers.
You made the point about the movie having a much larger orchestra. It's probably twice or three times the complement that played in the theaters or even.
Right.
Or many of the other cast recordings, but the vocal performances on the cast recording from the movie, they're more disappointing. I mean, because you're not seeing Johnny Depp's Helena Bonham face, and you hear them and you think, why, their voices are kind of weak.
So although to be honest with you, some of the supporting players in the movie are good.
The little boy who played Toby in that does a very nice job. And Sacha Baron Cohen as Pirelli is this comic stitch, you know, for his part in that. So yeah, there are things that recommend that one also.
Yes. So what is next for you? Are we going to have another Stephen Sondheim book? Are you going to tackle another musical? Are you going to, what's next for you?
Well, the simple answer is I'm not sure.
Okay.
The encyclopedia took me about 2 years to write.
Mm-hmm.
This one about a year. And I'm not, now that it's just coming out, I'm going to be spending the months ahead doing interviews with good folks like you and trying to, you know, get people to know about the book and perhaps pick up a copy of it. So I'm not sure. I live in Cincinnati and I write about theater locally. I'm a theater critic here. And so a lot of my otherwise writing is about that sort of thing. And I love all kinds of theater, not just musicals. Mm-hmm. Musicals are something that I'm particularly in love with. And it wouldn't surprise me if at some point I decide, I've been thinking that it might be fun to pick up another Sondheim show and Which one would it be? I'm not sure. I thought maybe A Little Night Music would be fun to work with because it does have the film behind it that it was based on and that sort of thing. So, but that's total wild speculation. I haven't had any conversation with a publisher or anybody about it. We'll have to see how this one does. I've also done some other books about local history here in Cincinnati, and I might pick up one of those. I've done one called 100 Things to Do in Cincinnati Before You Die, and I've had three editions of it, and now about 3 years have passed, and time goes on, and restaurants change, and things like that, so I may decide to do another one of those.
Well, I will highly recommend that people pick up Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, Behind the Bloody Musical Masterpiece, by Rick Pender. It's been delightful chatting with you again, Rick. I recommend it. It's not a perfect, it's a great Halloween gift.
Yes.
Perfect for Halloween.
I will tell you, Donald, that my editor said, let's let this come out in October. It'll be perfect for Halloween.
I said, okay, done. You know
so
what?
That's part of why the title is Bloody Musical Masterpiece.
Yes. Well, because it's perfect for Halloween. But, yeah. You know, a lot of people like me, we start our end of the year holiday shopping in October also. So it's also a great gift for the holidays for anybody on your list who likes Sondheim or musical theater. Because it's brilliantly researched by Rick Pender. And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to read, and it makes you, the best thing you can say about it is it makes you want to sit down and pop in a cast recording of Sweeney Todd.
Good. And that's very much what I hope that in all of the writing that I do about theater is that I hope that it drives people to go and see a production that I've reviewed.
Right.
In case to just, let's go back. And I mean, you didn't mention it, but my appendix for the book is it's a song by song in order through it. And I think that it would be fun for someone to get one of the cast recordings and, you know, read the section about the Ballad of Sweeney Todd and listen to that. And then go on step by step through it. You will get a much better feeling for the show if you do that.
That's actually a really great recommendation to do that because Rick does his research and it's all in the book. And so there will be a link on the radio show page for you to go to Rick's website, which will give you then directions on how to find the book and where to purchase it directly from the publisher, which is the best place to get it. So, and again, congratulations, Rick, on another terrific book.
I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about this today, Donald. Thank you.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. His skin was pale and his eye was odd.
He shaved the faces of gentlemen who never thereafter were heard of again. He trod a path that few have trod. De Sweeney Todd, the demon bomber of Fleet Street.
He kept a shop in London town, of fancy clients and good renown.
And what if none of their souls were saved? They went to their maker impeccably shaved.
My Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Swing your razor blades all into the skies. Trickles the blood of those who mortalize.
He sleeps a few, his room is bare. He hardly uses his fancy chair. The more he lives, the more he lives. He never forgets and he never forgives. Perhaps today you gave a nod to Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street.
Sweeney wishes the world away. Sweeney's weeping for yesterday. Hugging the plane, waiting the years. Hearing the music that nobody hears.
Sweeney, there beside you, Sweeney,
wishes the world away.
Sweeney,
sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney, sweeney
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
He served a dark and a hungry god.
To seek revenge may lead to hell.
But everyone does it, though seldom as well. A Sweeney Todd.
The demon barber of Fleet Street.